Mark Twain, one of his famous quotes is, "The two most important days of your life are the day that you're born and the day that you find out why." And that was the day I found out why.
Thank you for joining Crazy Good Turns. I'm your host, Frank Blake, and for a long time, I've looked forward to today's discussion with Jordan Kaslow. Jordan is the founder of one of the most innovative charities in the world. And in addition to having changed the lives of millions of people around the globe, Jordan is also the author of an incredible new book titled Dare to Matter. We didn't even know about this book when we first asked Jordan on the show. But since then, I've read the book. I'll be honest, I read it again, and it just blew me away. There are so many great insights, practical insights, insights into vision, how you think about changing your life and what matters to you. I love this book so much that I want to give it away to 50 listeners like you. So after you've heard what Jordan has to say in this show, you can sign up for your chance to win by going to crazygoodturns.org/daretomatter. You don't want to miss this book. It's a great read, and I want to give it to you free. All you have to do is go to crazygoodturns.org/daretomatter. That's dare, T-O, matter. All one word, no spaces, and enter for your chance to win. Okay, so without further ado, here's our interview with Jordan. Welcome, Jordan. It's great to have you on the show.
Thank you, Frank. It's lovely to be here. I really look forward to our conversation.
You have an amazing story of finding your purpose. Would you share that for our audience?
Absolutely. Very few people can say that there was a moment in time that fundamentally transformed their lives, but I could point to just that moment. I was 23 years old. I was studying to be an eye doctor and joined an organization that brought eye care to underserved populations in Mexico. Well, there we were in a small town about 30 miles from Merida, which is in the Yucatan Peninsula. And when we arrived at the clinic, there were 2,000 people in line, winding around the building multiple times. It was like Apple had just released its latest iPhone. And there were babies to people in their 90s waiting on this hot line in the sun. There were mothers with babies carrying them in traditional garb. And my very first patient was a 7-year-old boy who was blind. Or he thought he was blind. His parents thought he was blind. That was Raul. And his mother had that look of almost desperate concern of, is there any hope for my child? And you have to realize that blindness in those parts of the world are analogous to being, there's a lot of witchcraft kind of thinking, and it's like being cursed. And not only was he cursed, but the family was cursed because they had a blind person. So there's a lot of social ostracization. And after examining his eyes, we recognized that his eyes were perfectly healthy, but he just needed a super strong pair of eyeglasses. For your audience out there, some people might know their prescriptions as -2 or -3 or -6 or -8, very high nearsighted patients. This boy was a -20, meaning he couldn't even see an inch past his nose. I found the glasses, and it was like a 90% match for his prescription. And as I aligned the lenses with his eyes, and he saw for the first time, this universal smile of joy just spread across his face. His eyes widened, and it was the most joyful smile that you could ever imagine. And it was a look of both joy and amazement at the same time. I knew at that moment that if I could replicate that a bunch of times over, that I would be successful, no matter how many cars I had or how many apartments I had. If I could change people's lives in such a real way, I knew that was a path to success. Mark Twain, one of his famous quotes is, "The two most important days of your life are the day that you're born and the day that you find out why." And that was the day I found out why.
Wow. Wow. What an amazing story. Did you have much volunteer experience before that moment?
That was my first volunteer experience in my life, and he was my first patient as well. It was transformative, to say the least.
Did you imagine when you were doing that, when you were going to Mexico, that it would have that? Were you looking for that sort of effect, or did that just completely take you by surprise?
Well, it's interesting. If you roll back the clock 6 months before that, I was in the northern reaches of Alaska with two friends climbing in the Brooks Range, and I took a solo hike up a mountain during an extremely windy, rainy day. And as I was hiking up that mountain, the world was conspiring to tell me that I was insignificant and that I was meaningless. And it was sort of that dust in the wind kind of moment. And I remember literally screaming at the wind, telling them that I mattered. And it was a moment where I dared to matter, although I really didn't know how or why. So I was looking for a vehicle to make a difference in the world. And my heart was open to such an experience, but I had no idea that would be the moment. And when I went down to Mexico, it was really more to have a cool opportunity to help some people, to travel, to get out of the normal routine of being a student. So I wasn't necessarily expecting it at that moment, but I did have an open heart, and I was looking for something that showed me that I did make a difference and that my life was worth living.
You have this amazing moment. How did you decide what to do next?
Well, that was my first patient. We saw 2,000 patients during that week, and I can tell you other very powerful stories, none quite like that because that was the first, but other transformative stories of providing people with vision for the first time. And when I got back to Boston, we analyzed the numbers, and we saw that there were 2,000 patients that we saw during that week. 70% of them just needed a simple pair of eyeglasses, and half of them just needed a simple pair of reading glasses, the kind that you or I could get at the drugstore for $10. So a third of our effort were going into providing a service that in America was just a consumer product, and I thought that was ridiculous, and that really was the spark that made me think there must be a better way to approach this problem than having eye doctors flying halfway around the world to care for people who, many of whom just needed simple ready-made reading glasses so they could continue their work as weavers and tailors and artisans and coffee bean spreaders and counters. And so that was the spark that made me ultimately find Vision Spring.
Maybe this is a good time for you to describe for our audience how Vision Spring works. How does it help?
Well, what I noticed in Mexico that I just mentioned, that a third of the people who needed eye care just needed simple ready-made reading glasses, I sort of got the notion that, well, why couldn't we just train local women to start selling eyeglasses? There were many women who needed jobs, and there were many people in their communities who needed simple vision services like these ready-made reading glasses so they could continue to work in their jobs. We got that idea of starting what we call our Vision Entrepreneur Program. And we got enough money to train 18 women in India on how to do that. And about a third of them made some money, a third of them lost some money, and a third of them broke even. And we've been iterating ever since what made this woman successful, what made the third unsuccessful. And we've developed models over the last decade that have expanded to now we have over 30,000 women in business who are selling these ready-made reading glasses throughout the world in 23 countries. The first year we sold 800 pair of glasses. It took us 10 years to sell 1 million pair, and now we're selling over 1 million per year through those programs. Now we have other models in addition to the Vision Entrepreneur models. We have wholesale businesses now and retail businesses, and we work with supply chains of large companies. So we have a bunch of different ways to sell glasses, but that was the root of our work at Vision Spring, the Vision Entrepreneur Program.
One of the interesting things about this, from my perspective, is that you approach the problem not by doing something like donating glasses or donating and recycling glasses, but by selling them. Why take that approach?
Well, this goes back to a story when I was still a student and we were using the volunteer program and the donating of the glasses. there I was a year later after I met Raul in Mexico, that 7-year-old boy I referred to. And this time we were in the western state of Choco, Colombia. It's the poorest state of Colombia, and it's called Choco because of the Choco Indians that live there. And we set up a temporary clinic. Again, we saw 2,000 patients. And in the throes of a very busy day, I met a woman named Noka, who was in her mid-40s, and she was known as the blind lady in her village, and she had canoed a full day downriver to come to our clinic. She, like that boy, was very nearsighted. She had never gotten a pair of glasses in her 40-plus years of living, and we prescribed, she had a very unusual prescription with astigmatism, and we had one pair of glasses that really matched what she needed, and we gave it to her, and we were all very proud that we had provided vision services and turned this blind lady into a sighted woman and got back to work. 2 days later, Noka reappears at the clinic and started to tell the story through Indian tongue, Spanish, English translation that when she got back to the village, everyone was laughing at her because her glasses looked so ridiculous and she wanted a different pair. And we explained to her that the only pair we had that came even close to her very unusual prescription were the pair that she had. She was right in saying that the glasses were inappropriate because although they matched her prescription, the only frame that we had was a 1950s cat-eye pair of glasses with rhinestones. And you can imagine this woman who was living in the frontiers of Colombia wearing traditional Indian garb. Those glasses did look totally ridiculous on her and culturally inappropriate. After we explained that to her, she did something that sort of blew all of our minds. She took the glasses off, she put them on a wooden table, and she went back upriver blind again. And it just stopped me in my tracks. I realized that if this woman is choosing blindness over what we're providing, we're doing something fundamentally wrong. And what we were doing fundamentally wrong is we were not taking into consideration the dignity of Noka and the fact that glasses, whether you're rich or poor, are sitting right in the middle of your face, and they have to be culturally appropriate. They have to be aspirational. They have to make you feel good about yourself. Otherwise, you're not going to wear them. And so that's when I started to think we've got to do it a different way. And if we charge for the glasses, then we get an immediate market feedback loop that if people are actually paying their hard-earned dollars for those glasses, albeit a small amount because that's all they could afford, it was a testament to that we were providing them with products and services that they valued enough to pay for. And that's the moment where I recognized that that was necessary.
That is so brilliant, and there's so much packed into that one story. I want to take maybe a part of that, because one of the things I noticed on your website, and I wish it were on the website of every single company in the country, is you have a section on listening. How you listen, what you listen for, and why you listen. Would you give some context for that? It's one of the first times I've seen it on any website, that emphasis on listening.
Well, when it comes down to solving problems and the whole field of social entrepreneurship, is that you're working with people, not problems. And all of the challenges that we face have a cultural and an anthropological and a local context to them. And unless you have a clear understanding of what those are, you're not going to develop products and services that speak to the needs and the desires and the aspirations of the people that you're serving. So the very first thing that we do always is listening to the people who we want to make our customers. And we want to develop products and services that serve their needs, not something that we think they need. We have to understand what they want and desire and then create the product that is appropriate for them. So listening is very key, and understanding local and cultural context is critical.
And it is such a different approach, frankly, from a lot of companies and a lot of charitable efforts. They don't start with that listening exercise. I just think it's brilliant that you emphasize that so much. if I got it right, you started Vision Spring originally as a philanthropic arm of your for-profit business. Then a few years later, you decided to focus solely on the foundation. What was behind that personal shift for you?
Well, also, there was a bit of a watershed moment there for me. I remember I was one of our customers on the for-profit business side was Bloomingdale's. And I was sitting with the buyer of Bloomingdale's, who was a good customer, and we were talking about what color red was going to be in style for that year. We started to parse the different reds, and there I was just a few days. I had just returned from India, where we were rolling up our sleeves and doing the important work and providing vision services to people who didn't have access to them. And I was like, why am I sitting here deciding what kind of red there is? There's more, so much more important things to be doing. And that was a moment where I said, I really want to, over time, shift my energy to the work that I love, that I'm passionate about, that needs me most. One of the things in life that I think is critical to happiness is the feeling of being needed. And to help our listeners think about what is the need out there that needs you most and try to align your life with that. And so that was the moment where I realized that the need that needed me most was not the determination of what red was going to be in our seasonal line, but the people who were there in India who had no other option for eye care other than Vision Spring.
If I go back to something that you've written about that first experience in Mexico, one of the things you wrote was that you decided that if you could replicate that moment 1,000 times over, you'd have led a meaningful life. Is that definition of meaningful life tied to what you just described in terms of need and meeting needs, or how else would you define it?
Yeah, actually, I've just written a book called Dare to Matter, Your Path to Making a Difference Now. And in that book, my co-author Jen Krause and I talk about the fact that every human has two fundamental needs. One is the need to take care of themselves, and the other is the need to take care of something beyond themselves. And then what you realize is if you tend to the need beyond yourself, it in fact is a feedback loop, and ultimately the benefit inures to yourself. And so trying to find a life where you integrate those two very human needs is critical for a happy life, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, that definitely sounds like a book well worth reading. That's a profound concept. Are there any people who, as you've gone on this journey, have been instrumental in your learning that you look and you say, boy, the input from that person made a huge difference to me on my path?
Well, it's funny because most of the people who have provided me with the most key insights and learnings are people like Raul Anoka, who I've just mentioned. There was a woman who I met in central Cameroon. She was an illiterate farmer, and I was working at that time on a disease called river blindness, and going throughout the villages of central Cameroon and talking to people to better understand what they needed and what they valued most. Again, sort of a listening tour. And I would always ask people that question. And as you can imagine, that list were things like health, better health care, better education, better housing, better water, better agricultural products. But when I met this particular woman, she said, we really have only one fundamental need, and that is opportunity. Because if we have opportunity, we can be self-reliant. And just like you, we want to be self-reliant. And then we can take care of all of our other needs. And it was really a profound moment where I realized that the meta need out there is the ability to provide people with opportunity so that they can be self-reliant and take care of their families the way that they see best fit. That was another spark of a moment where I realized that vision was opportunity. Vision enabled children to thrive in school. Vision enabled weavers and tailors to thrive in the workplace and to stay employed. Vision enabled people to be safe on the roads and secure ambulating from place to place in their homes. So vision was a critical input to opportunity. So that was another incredibly important lesson. So some of the most important lessons I've learned were from kind of unlikely characters that I've met throughout my travels in very remote parts of the world.
One of the things I noticed on your website, you talk about providing people the dignity of choice, which connects directly to your last comment. In addition to that woman's comment, is that something that's developed over time that you've seen that, or did that too come with sort of the same spark of recognition?
Well, I think the dignity of choice came largely from that experience I had in Colombia with NOCA, but then I saw it over and over again, that wherever you were, there were certain kinds of colors and shapes of frames that mattered to people and that were culturally appropriate for them. And so before we would develop a line of products for any particular part of the world, we would make sure we get the color and shapes correct. So that was key. It was also key to our business model because, again, if we were expecting people to pay for the services and the products, we needed to give them that choice and to have the dignity to decide what they wanted to look like.
What's been the toughest thing in your journey? What has surprised you as being more difficult than you thought it would be, or obstacles that you didn't expect?
Well, one of them was, I thought incorrectly, that this was just a supply side problem, that if we were able to make glasses accessible and affordable and people aware of them, that we would solve the problem on its own. It would almost be like a cell phone. It would spread like wildfire and become viral. But what we've realized is that that's not the case. We've had to spend a lot of time showing people the value of vision. Until you know what proper vision looks like, people don't value it. So if you ask somebody and you show them a pair of glasses and you say, would you pay $3 for these glasses? They would say, no, I don't need them. But then if you showed them the way that something looked before they put the glasses on, and then after they put them on, if they needed them, they would say, oh my God, that's the way the world's supposed to look. And they would be shocked. And then you ask them the same question, and they would say, yeah, definitely I would spend $3 because I'd like to see that way rather than the way I've always seen. So creating that demand and waking up that awareness has been a very hard task for us, and it's been harder than we anticipated. There are also a lot of cultural biases against wearing glasses. And in China, for instance, there's a notion that wearing glasses make your eyes worse, which is absolutely not the case. In India, a lot of women think that glasses, if they wear glasses, they'll be less marriageable because of a genetic defect, if you will, which is a cultural bias against glasses. In places like Cambodia, where there were images of piles of glasses from people who were killed by Pol Pot because they were part of the intellectual class, there's a bias against wearing glasses.
Wow.
So these are all the kinds of things that we have to face as we try to get people to adopt wearing glasses and using them.
So you're maybe uniquely positioned, having run a very successful for-profit business, having this amazing nonprofit business, to give a perspective on the following. Do you have different hiring criteria? Do you look for different kinds of people to put in your for-profit side when you were running that, or the nonprofit, or the skill sets largely the same from your perspective?
From my perspective, the skill sets are the same. We think of business as a force for good. We think of the business skills that we use every day to make profit here are the same skills that can be used to affect change and solve large social problems. There's no way that there's enough charitable dollars in the world to solve a problem as big as what we're addressing. There are over a billion people in the world who are visually impaired or blind, not because of an eye disease, but just because they need a simple pair of glasses. And there are just not enough charitable dollars in the world to solve that problem. So we need to take a business approach. We need to wake up the market. We need to create the market. And so those skills, whether they're sitting on the for-profit side of a business or the nonprofit side of the business, are largely the same.
This is going to be an impossible question for you to answer, but I'm going to give it to you anyways. I am so impressed by everything I've heard about you, and in addition, you've earned a number of amazing accolades from the Aspen Institute, the World Bank, and that's just to name a few. If you had to identify, here are some of the attributes that you have as a leader that has made this possible, what would they be?
I think the most important thing about a leader is to have people want to follow you. And I think people want to follow people who are passionate about solving problems that are real and important and affecting the lives of other people. The key differentiator of, I think, a good leader and a leader who often has trouble getting people to follow them is that it's not about yourself. It's about solving a problem. It's about helping other people. And if you're passionate and authentic about that, people pick that up pretty quickly, and they want to follow, and they want to put their shoulder to the wheel and help you solve the problem that you're so passionate about. So it's a passionate cause. It's living for something beyond yourself. And people have really good radars for people who are doing that and who are driven by solving important problems versus it being about yourself as the leader.
For the folks listening to this and who have interest in doing crazy good turns, in thinking about how they can make their lives meaningful, is there advice that you've picked up along the way that you'd want to give to them?
Yeah, so in terms of solving or getting people to think about ways in which they can start to put more of their energy toward things and efforts that help other people and therefore in turn help them, the book Dare to Matter really is my effort to create a 10-chapter blueprint of principles that have helped me think about ways to do that. And so just very simple things like the practice of gratitude, the observation of where your feet take you in life, because where your feet take you is who you are, and to be mindful of that, to small acts of kindness. If you're in a subway car and someone comes who's an elderly person comes in and it's a crowded subway car, don't look to your right and left to see who's going to stand up. Be the first to stand up. Just simple practices like that can make a difference. And the book is a principle-based book to help people get handles on how to make a life that makes a difference in the world.
Sounds like a phenomenal book. Would you just elaborate on the one thing you said on where your feet take you and how we pay attention to where our feet take us?
Yeah, it's not a surprise that we are, who we are is fundamentally how we act in the world. And how we act in the world is dependent on where we're showing up. And where we're showing up is where our feet take us. And so it's really an action-based analysis of what your life is all about. And we believe that action is the key to measuring one's life. Words are wonderful, but it's really where your feet take you, your actions, that determine the importance of your life.
It's such an important principle that people mistake intention for what their ultimate destination is versus what their actual actions are.
That's right.
Which is, yeah. Well, your intentions and your actions could not align more perfectly. In addition to your book, are there other ways for people to connect with you on social media or otherwise, other things you might want to reference?
Probably the best place to go is to visionspring.org. We have an excellent website that is quite comprehensive. VisionSpring also has a Twitter handle at VisionSpring and a Facebook page, so you can follow us through social media there. So those are some of the ways in which you can follow our work.
Thank you again. Thank you so much for being on this podcast. This has been a great episode.
I appreciate your time very much, Frank, and thanks for this wonderful conversation.
Once again, that was Jordan Caslow of VisionSpring. To find out more about Jordan and his mission, you can visit visionspring.org. Jordan's new book, Dare to Matter, is on sale. And believe me, it is worth buying and reading. As I said at the start of the episode, I love this book so much that we're giving away 50 copies of it, with one grand prize winner getting a special edition, autographed by Jordan himself, as well as a copy of 10 of his top favorite books. So sign up for your chance to win at crazygoodturns.org/daretomatter. That's dare, T-O, matter, all one word, no spaces. Our show was recorded at Listen Up Studios in Atlanta, editing by Stephen Key and mixing by Score Score in Los Angeles. Special thanks to our production team of Brian Sabin and Megan Hanlon. Until next time, I'm Frank Blake, and thank you for celebrating another Crazy Good Turn with us.